everyone. I'm very happy today to have James Medeo, who's come down all the way from Manchester, to give a talk for us. He's currently just about to finish his PhD, which is on Vidyaranya, the pre-colonial Advaita. And he's going to be talking today on the contested category of Neo-Vedanta, Swami Vivekananda, and the multi-locality of pre-colonial Advaita Vedantic tradition.
Thank you very much, Lucian. I really appreciate you inviting me here. It's an honor to be here. I prepared this sort of like a conference paper, so I feel I perhaps should have done it a little differently, but I'll just say a little bit of the background of how I sort of came to this. I initially started at postgraduate school about 6 years ago, and I was doing a project on Yoga Vasishta, which was a very important sort of medieval narrative Advaitic work, and the residences of that work are found in many colonial period Neo-Vedantins, as they're typically called, Shivananda, Chinmayananda, Swami Vivekananda, even Ramana Maharshi. I had always sort of seen these connections. And I had also, before I came to a postgraduate program, I was under the sort of assumption that one would study Indian traditions by reading sort of contemporary Indian authors as a way to sort of get into the tradition. And then as I sort of went through university, there was a bit of a hands-off, these colonial period Vedantins, we don't really study them to learn about Vedanta, sort of deconstruct them. So I had gone off to Pune for a couple of years to study Sanskrit, and there's sort of a different world. In India, there's sort of a different scholastic world than there is in the West, if you will, in certain ways, and there's lots of overlap too, but particularly at how Advaita Vedanta is looked at, right? So many of the connections between sort of what's happening in Neo-Vedanta are very obvious, actually, in the Indian context, because, as I'll talk about in this sort of, there's somewhat of a selective historiography of the tradition when we talk about Advaita Vedanta. There are certain text genres that are ignored. And so this became very awkward for me. So, just sort of Shankara being sort of authentic Advaita Vedanta and not anything later than that, there seemed to be this strange way that the field has been divided up. So depictions of Swami Vivekananda in scholarly literature often read as if instantiations of a singular explanatory model. This widespread approach locates the ideology and development of Vivekananda's theological innovativeness in terms of Western influence, and in particular, nationalism. Vivekananda's thought thus emerges from this line of inquiry as an eclectic derivative of the colonial encounter. This assessment is typically reinforced by appealing to earlier Indological scholarship that portrayed Vivekananda's Neo-Vedantic theology as a rupture from traditional Hinduism, particularly the orthodox Uttara Mimamsa of the 8th century Shankara. Although there are certainly insights to be gained from this account, it does, however, entirely omit theological developments in medieval and early modern Indic traditions. This is remarkable because Swami Vivekananda repeatedly references numerous pre-colonial Indian philosophical works and Advaitic texts. Vivekananda's orientation toward Indic sources is evident, for example, in a letter to Alasingha Perumal. Quote, in translating, pay no attention to the Orientalists. Explain according to our sages and not according to so-called European scholars, end quote. Vivekananda had a great deal of admiration for foreign scholars, but this remark is certainly a sign that he rejected wholesale purchase of Western exegesis and ideas. In the proceeding discussion, I would like to problematize the category Neo-Vedanta, which has become part of the standard lexicon of South Asianists. In that way, if we are calling something neo or new, what exactly is the alterity or otherness from which this comparison is drawn? I argue that scholarly interest in historical origins and certain modalities of traditional Advaita Vedanta underrepresents the multivocality of Advaita Vedantic theology, and it is precisely the underrepresented periods and text genres which were key sources for so-called Neo-Vedantins, particularly Vivekananda. My argument therefore seeks to complicate categories of comparison constructed in mid-20th century Indological scholarship, still evident in post-colonial approaches to the Swami. Now, the mid-20th century disciplinary trend of mostly European Indology tended, not unlike its predecessors, toward the investigation of classical texts, often privileging the status of foundational sutras, commentaries, and recensions. With regard to the study of Advaita Vedanta, this type of Indology focused on analysis of the earliest period of the tradition, particularly the quest for the historical Shankara. I leave out here specific details, but a number of groundbreaking scholars in the field during this period developed an important methodology for determining criteria for adjudicating which, out of the some 300 works, were actually authored by the historical, that is, Adi or first Shankara. Their results establish that the commentaries on the Triple Foundation, or Prasthana Trayi, of Advaita Vedanta, along with one independent work, the Upadesha Sahasri, were authored by the 8th century Shankara. As important as these findings are, they have functioned, at least in the Western Academy, as a kind of precedent for what counts as authentic Advaita Vedanta. In that way, the mid-20th century Indological concern for philosophically reconstructing early Advaita Vedanta, as well as the historical biography and authentic works of Shankara, brought about a perhaps unintended consequence. Later Advaita Vedantic works, particularly texts attributed to Shankara but of later authorship, are all too often judged against the authenticity of the Shankarite commentarial corpus. This judgment, in fact, carries with it the subtle sense that such texts and their soteriological and hermeneutical modalities are inauthentic beyond the issue of authorship. Scholarly trends are indeed not objective enterprises, but indexes of value that construct frames of reference through explanatory historiographical models. Notably, the bifurcation between traditional and neo-Advaita Vedanta, so often found in scholarly works on Vivekananda, is largely indebted to the influential and, I argue, deeply problematic model proposed by the scholar-theologian Paul Hawker. Hawker popularized the view that neo-Vedanta was a nationalist movement dependent on the assimilation of Western and Christian ideals. The category neo-Vedanta in that way entered mainstream academic discourse as a pejorative term, indiscriminately used in reference to a number of Indian thinkers who held variant theological views and connoting a sense of inauthenticity because, quote, continuity with the past has been broken. I can only gesture here that Hawker's Eurocentric and Christian polemical context, as well as his Orientalist periodization of Indian history. What is more important to the present discussion is that Hawker's horizon of understanding remains the range of vision for the majority of contemporary approaches. This horizon, in other words, is the two-track method of analyzing Swami Vivekananda in terms of Western influence and or contrasting Vivekananda's eclectic Vedanta to a vaguely defined orthodoxy or traditionalism, typically conflated with the historical Shankara of the 8th century. Now, both in Hawker and in subsequent scholarly works, a number of issues typically seen as originating in Western thought have been identified as the dividing line between Vivekananda's Vedanta and traditional Advaita Vedanta. I don't have time to address all of these issues in this paper, and I'm certainly not denying Western influence on Vivekananda. But my hope is to change the frame of the debate by taking seriously pre-colonial Advaita Vedantic voices that were indeed known to Vivekananda. To start, I'd like to draw from perhaps the most well-known academic biography of Vivekananda by Narasingha Sill in order to demonstrate how the alterity of an undistinguished Shankarite orthodoxy tends to function when situating Vivekananda's theology. Sill, for example, asserts that, quote, unfortunately, his, meaning Vivekananda's, success as a Vedantist in the West owed to his distortion of the traditional Advaita system as expounded by Shankaracharya, Vivekananda's emphasis on the superconscious state, that is, Nirvikalpa Samadhi, has no imprimatur from the Upanishads, the primary source of Vedanta, end quote. I will return to Nirvikalpa Samadhi shortly, but the ruler for Sill's comparison is the Shankara of the 8th century. Tied up as it is with the Indological quest for origins, the Shankara who exists in Indological articles has, of course, very little to do with Shankara as he is understood in medieval and early modern Advaita Vedantin muttas. Neither does Sill's depiction take into consideration the various developments across Advaita Vedantic traditions post-Shankara. Indeed, what Advaita Vedantins of different allegiances share is not a uniform theology, whether in terms of philosophical positions, sadhanic praxeology, pedagogical strategies, or hermeneutical practices, but rather common architectural elements. That phrase is from Lawrence McCrae and Parimal Patel. Such structural commonalities include lineages of teachers and authoritative scriptural genres. Now, generally speaking, Vedantins ground their positions in the paradigmatic categories of Shruti and Smriti, but these are not, however, a fixed canon. They are also generative. New Upanishads, that is, the yogic and samyasic, continued to be recorded through the early medieval period onward. And narrative works, for example, the Yoga Vasishta and Bhagavata Purana, were drawn on authoritatively in often radically different theological situations than Shankara's. Returning to Searle's assessment, we might ask how Vivekananda's teaching on Nirvikalpa Samadhi would look in the context of, say, the 14th century Advaitavedantin work, Jivan Mukti Viveka, which was authored by Vidyaranya, a Shankaracharya from Sringeri Mutha that Vivekananda lavishly praised. The Jivan Mukti Viveka not only endorses meditational yoga as essential to both realizing non-duality and securing it post-realization, but also identifies Nirvikalpa Samadhi with the highest stage of Jivan Mukti, or liberation while living. The JMV is the Jivan Mukti Viveka, in fact, draws repeatedly on the Yoga Shastra as an authoritative text, and at the behest of the fictive interlocutor, argues that Patanjali Yoga indirectly implies the seeing that is the self, Atma Darshana. In fact, the soteriological utilization of yoga, and in particular stages of samadhi, extends across a range of medieval Advaitavedantic works, including prakaranas attributed to Shankara, such as Viveka Chudamani, a work frequently drawn on by Vivekananda as well as at traditional muttas, but traditional in quotes, but largely ignored in scholarly discussion. The diversity of Advaitavedantic interest in yoga, in fact, extends even beyond the quiescence and absorptive meditative practices associated with Patanjali. In the 16th and 17th centuries, for example, certain Natha and Hatha yoga texts were also viewed as authoritative on yoga by 17th century Advaitavedantins such as Shivananda Sarasvati and Narayana Tirtha. Other issues that have been identified as the fault line between traditional and neo-Vedanta include Vivekananda's decentralization of scripture and his concomitant valorization of experience. Although I cannot unpack these arguments here, it is worth underscoring that such comparisons repeatedly conflate Advaitavedanta with the 8th century Shankara. The picture, of course, is more nuanced when post-Shankarite traditions are taken into consideration. For example, in verse 474, the Viveka Chudamani, Shastra, reason or yukti, the words of the preceptor, Deshika, are indicated as sources of knowing or pramanas. However, the verse also emphatically states, Cha antaha siddha swanubhutihi pramanam, that is, the accomplishment which is one's own inner experience is a source of knowing or pramana. There are, in fact, 37 usages of anubhava in Viveka Chudamani, often in compounds with ananda, as well as the experientially tinged term rasa. We also find ambivalence towards scripture. Take the paradoxical verse 59. When ultimate reality is not known, the understanding of the scripture is useless. And when the ultimate reality is known, the understanding of scripture is also useless. So we might indeed ask ourselves when Neo-Vedanta starts. Is Vidyaranya's unabashed endorsement of yogic praxis a Neo-Vedantic Raja Yoga? Is the Viveka Chudamani a kind of Neo-Vedantic mysticism? Are the teachings on Kundalini and the goddess in the Saundarya Lahari, a medieval work attributed to Shankara and central to the Sri Vidya Shakta traditions endorsed by the Advaitavedantic muttas at Kanchipuram and Sringeri, a type of Neo-Vedantic eclecticism? How new are Neo-Vedantic models of Hinduism in light of what Max Müller called a certain freedom of thought in medieval doxographical traditions? When the great 16th century Advaitavedanta Napaya Dikshita, in his Chaturmata Sara Samgraha, pays homage to not only Shankara, but also Madhva, Ramanuja, and Srikanta, is this Neo-Vedantic ecumenism. The continuing persistence of an overgeneralized traditional versus neo framework and scholarly discourse is due in part to a selective historiography of the Advaitavedantic text tradition. Just as periodization involves hidden theories and value judgments, the scholarly privileging of some text genres over others is part of a long history of overemphasizing not only the Shankarite period, but also a Pandita-informed image of Advaitavedanta. There are, however, other Advaitavedantic patterns of praxis, theological textures, and text genres which do not conform to a mimamsa-centric or nyayic dialectical mold emphasized in the majority of scholarly studies. The dismissive treatment of Advaita Vedanta hagiographies, which are often viewed as pseudo-history for the informed scholar to debunk, is an issue that is indeed caught up in the Indological notion of a philosophically pure Advaita Vedanta. Regardless of the fact that the hagiographies of Shankara likely emerged during or after the 14th century, not unlike the muttas in their current institutional form, they have greatly shaped the lived tradition of Advaita Vedanta on the ground. The overlooking of medieval prakaranas in hagiographies is similarly related to the ignoring of the vast array of stotras in Advaita Vedantic traditions. And hagiographies such as the Shankara Digvijaya include stotras in narrativized contexts. Vivekananda was in fact familiar with works from those genres and the theological articulations within them which challenge scholarly depictions of an Advaita Vedanta unconcerned with experience and ethics. Even though stotras are perhaps the most pervasive genre of Sanskrit literature, bhakti and the practical role it plays in post-Shankarite Advaita Vedantic traditions has barely provoked scholarly interest. As the stotras bear witness, bhakti, as with yoga, was not newly integrated with Advaita Vedantic commitments in the colonial period. The Advaitic theism, to use Dan Sheridan's phrase, of the Bhagavata Purana, for example, was authoritative not only for the Goswamis of Navadvipa, but also among Advaita Vedantins from Karnataka to Orissa. Notably, as early as the 14th century, the Bhagavata Purana was drawn on authoritatively by Vidyaranya, and was later the source text for an influential commentary by Sridhara, an understudied renunciate linked to the Advaita Vedantic Mutta at Puri, and a figure to whom, incidentally, Swami Vivekananda refers. The Bhagavata Purana was also formative to the theology of the mid-16th century Advaita Vedantin Madhusudana Sarasvati, who argued on behalf of a complete and independent path to liberation by means of bhakti. Also of interest in this discussion is the utilization of the Shandilya and Narada Bhakti Sutras in Advaita Vedantic Sampradayas in the 17th century, such as in the work of the Advaita Vedanta Narayana Tirtha, an issue of particular interest since Swami Vivekananda utilizes both the Shandilya and Narada Bhakti Sutras as sources for his Bhakti Yoga lectures. The absence for any contextualizing discussion of medieval and early modern Advaita Vedantic traditions in scholarly presentations, including the wider context of Sanskritic and vernacular Advaita traditions, can leave the impression that Advaitic theology was resurrected from an ancient past in the service of nationalism, thereby laying the foundation for contemporary Hindutva politics. I'm referring here to Jyotirmaya Sharma's recent account. One of the problems with this kind of depiction is that Advaitic traditions were not fossilized, to use his word, artifacts unearthed by the Royal Asiatic Society as if Egyptian coffin texts, but thriving on the subcontinent before and after, say, the naval battle of Swali off the coast of Gujarat in 1612. Indeed, it was in the medieval and early modern periods that the intellectual production of Advaita Vedantic traditions amassed an enormous quantity of modern Sanskrit literature. In his recent social history of Advaita Vedanta, Christopher Minkowski, for example, points out that from the 16th century to the colonial period, quote, Advaitin sannyasins and householders occupied positions of prominence in the literate institutions and public spaces of Benares, end quote. Notably, out of the seven dominant Pandita families in Varanasi on the eve of colonialism, all except one held Advaita Vedantin commitments. In other words, quote, the intellectual scene in Benares was dominated by Advaita Vedanta so much that it can be considered, quote, the establishment position in the city, end quote. This Minkowski's article. Further, H.P. Shastri, and who serves as a source for Minkowski's article, has noted, quote, in 1791, the Benares Sanskrit College was established and the Dakshini Brahmanas were its principal professors. Even at the present moment, the Dakshini element preponderates in the staff of that college, end quote. These Dakshini Brahmanas, or Brahmins from the southern country, i.e. the Deccan, are indeed the Brahmin Pandita families of overwhelmingly Advaita Vedantin allegiances previously mentioned. Important in this context is the Anglo-Sanskrit professor at Benares Sanskrit College, Pramadadas Mitra. Well-versed in Advaita Vedantic traditions, he was connected to the Pandita community and also an associate of Swami Vivekananda. The letters sent from Vivekananda to Mitra document their close relationship and eventual philosophical divergence, They also record a number of Vivekananda's queries, such as those related to concordances across Indian traditions, texts on Sanskrit grammar, and comments on a range of philosophical theological issues. Vivekananda's questions reveal an individual keen to grapple with the diversity of Indic sources in order to verify and refine his own understanding. Although Ramakrishna's influence was certainly central, Vivekananda nonetheless encountered Advaitic traditions in multifarious forms during his renunciate travels across the subcontinent after the death of Ramakrishna, including multiple visits to Kashi, where he stayed at the house of Pramanadas Mitra. What is rarely discussed in articles on Vivekananda, however, is his study of Sanskrit and in Indian philosophical works. Although Vivekananda made numerous acquaintances with scholars and panditas, his works also demonstrate familiarity with Advaitic traditions prevalent on the ground, such as those from the neglected text genres mentioned earlier, which fall outside specialist practices of pandita circles or the arcane intellectuality of Navya-Nyaya sectarian dialectics. In making a provisional gesture at the historical transmission of ideas, I am not claiming that Vivekananda lacked innovation or that he was somehow uninfluenced by the episteme of his global cosmopolitan milieu. Indeed, it is the very vocation of a theologian to engage the exigencies of his or her contemporary situation. My argument is that Vivekananda is a theologian. I do argue, however, that our understanding of Vivekananda's innovations is directly proportional to our presently limited understanding of Advaitic traditions during the centuries that preceded it. I argue that a closer examination of neglected periods and genres reveals, in fact, theological currents that prefigure and are echoed in important aspects of Swami Vivekananda's neo-theological perspective. If we take a balanced approach to the cumulative tradition of Advaita Vedanta, that is, not privileging certain periods over others, not imposing evaluative judgments on high and low points of philosophical flourishing, and not marginalizing certain text genres or texts from certain periods over others, and combine this with more serious consideration of developments and practices related to the lived tradition of Advaita Vedanta on the ground, then a de-essentialized, polyvalent, and theologically expansive Advaita Vedanta emerges. From this vantage point, which is sensitive to varied historical, cultural, and linguistic contexts, essentialistic and dichotomous classifications, such as traditional and neo, orthodoxy and distortion, or blanket claims about ruptures with the past, are seen for what they are, neither particularly meaningful nor helpful. It is within the space that this recognition affords that scholarship on Swami Vivekananda, one of the most important Indian theologians of the 19th century and a pioneer of cross-cultural translation and pedagogy, can move beyond ossified categories and comparisons.
Thanks for that. I thought that was brilliant. I thought particularly sort of highlighting kind of what's implicit in a lot of these critiques is a kind of stagnant and artificial notion of the concept of tradition, really, yeah. which is sort of used as the yeah. as the criteria for whether something's authentic or not.
Exactly.
And I thought that you
yeah.
highlighted that really.
Yeah.
Sort of one question sure. that I had pertained to the nationalism in Vivekananda, which I think one can't really get away from too easily, and that would seem to be a marker of a rupture of some kind.
Right.
So it's just if you could.
Yeah. I mean, I agree that there are elements of nationalism there. I guess part of the background of, or the overall perspective I'm trying to convey is that there are many neo-Vedantas. So you can just sort of pick any period and look at a certain thinker. They're particularly, you know, sort of watershed thinkers as well. And all of them are engaging in the exigencies of their time. And that's what theologians do. They speak to their current situation. And that's what Vivekananda is doing. And so Catholic liberation theology in Latin America is nothing like Thomas Aquinas, but he's still a Catholic, as it were. Now, whether Swami Vivekananda, I mean, he self-identifies as an Advaitin. You know, there's gray area, certainly, in one, how we understand his understanding of Vedanta. But it's the kind of undercutting of, you know, well, he's merely interested in nationalism. He's just engaging in, Madame Blavatsky-like esoteric cosmology. He's only, he's influenced by the Bhadralokas and the, sort of the Western philosophical education in Calcutta at the time. And therefore, there's no reference to the Indic continuity and what Indic sources he's drawing from. He has full, he should be, any theologian should have full right, as it were. I mean, that's what you do. You engage the time and you draw from an array of sources. And that, I would say that is this, a mark of this time period and in Calcutta is that it's a global milieu, and he's therefore engaging in a global milieu, just as Madhusudana Saraswati is engaging in a certain situation happening with convergence of bhakti and Navya-Nyaya, which changes the categories of Advaita Vedanta, just as Vidyaranya is engaging with a yogic milieu of in an emergent mutta at Sringiri, and what's happening there with the dashanamis and all this sort of thing. It's, that's what he's doing. He's speaking to the time. I don't know if I answered.
No, sure. Totally. Yeah. I guess the question would be, if the nation had been sort of formed in the time of Shankara, would he be sort of engaging with that, with that concept? Mm. Anyways, that's a bit of a hypothetical. But I guess we'll open it up to. Yeah.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that. One thing that often strikes me of Vivekananda is sort of the Shakta influence, sort of the Bengali Shakta that he kind of inherits through Ramakrishna, that he seems sort of a bit uncomfortable with and kind of tries to do away with.
Yeah.
And I probably had too much of a static view of the Shankara, sort of the Advaita lineages before that. But I often thought of Vivekananda as basically somebody who's articulating Shakta theology, sort of Bengali Shakta theology of the late 18th, early 19th century through an Advaita sort of language and sort of framework and sort of bringing those two things. Now, does that make sense?
Yeah. This is one of the sort of classic charges too. I mean that he's cleaned up Ramakrishna and the interesting thing is that what's happening in the among the southern muttas, sort of at Kanchipuram and in Sringeri, which are always referred to as the traditional muttas, even though we seem to know absolutely nothing about what goes on there. I mean, there's literally I think two studies on Sringeri. They have this Sri Vidya, goddess worship. The Shankaracharya is at that time are also talking about Kundalini and goddess worship, and they have all sorts of pujas going on, and that is looked at as kind of that's a lineage that's supposed to go back to Shankara. I mean, it certainly goes back to at least the 14th century, it's impossible that Vivekananda was not aware of. I mean, he was familiar with those. Some of those texts, I mean, because he references them. Some we don't know exactly which texts. I mean, I sort of have somewhat of a list of things he explicitly mentions, but it would be very difficult to be unaware of that, what's happening. I mean, that's part of the sort of smarta Brahmin identity in the South. So it is, there is this Bengali sort of tantric situation going on. You're right. I mean, it is a different kind of Advaita Vedanta. He has a different kind of Advaita, and there's no doubt about that. But does Madhusudana Saraswati or someone like this also have a different kind of Advaita Vedanta? So, yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with the point, in any way, but it's just, how do we make sense of this without sort of just kind of, without notions of inauthenticity coming in, if there's constantly just constant change going on.
Kind of coming off of that and thinking, I like what you're doing part, brings out that sense in which Advaita never was a single tradition.
Yeah.
Philosophically, we know that there's lots of different variations in people, like from, you know, Richard King to Stanishwar to Milsena to Ledova. Everyone's trying to bring out the variations within that. And that's where I used to make fun of Vivekananda, because he's actually really charming, and so you feel like you should. And then you go back and read him, and you see what a lot of work he's doing on the text, and I think that's really interesting. And I suppose, I don't know if it's a question or a comment, I'd be interested to hear more about exactly what he's doing conceptually. Like, which Advaitas is he wanting more of? Because I think you're right, he is a creative Vedantic thinker, and there's no very, very strong distinction in some ways. But which Vedantas, and I think that in that context, the Shaktivedanta point is really interesting. I was reading a book, a very poor book on Veda Veda, which included at the end of the list of different kinds of Veda Vedas, starting with Oscar or whatever going on, ended with Bengali Shakta as a Veda Veda position, because it's kind of a monism that includes plurality and transition and blah. And obviously, therefore, kind of like Richard King tries to differentiate Gaudapada's consciousness-based Advaita from what he sees as Shankara is actually much more Veda Veda transformation and materiality Advaita. It makes me wonder where Vivekananda falls on that wide, rich, wonderful range of Advaitas.
Much work to be done. Right? I mean, one two things. I like I will speak to that. But it's interesting, even from the inception of Advaita Vedanta. I mean, was Shankara a Neo-Vedantin from Gaudapada's perspective, which is interesting. You know, I mean, and the, you know, there is this. The letters of Vivekananda are, I think, the key, actually. Because what I find in studies, there have been some works that have looked at Vivekananda's theology, and they treat his works as if they are kind of systematic theology or philosophy. When he's speaking towards, when they're actually in pedagogical encounters, and often cross-cultural pedagogical encounters, where, I mean, you look at some of the places he's speaking at. He's speaking, you know, at a Unitarian church in Connecticut. He's speaking at the Women's Club in Boston. He's speaking to some theosophy group in California or something. And he's taking up different ideals. So and you begin to get this in Madhusudana, so this notion of different paths, different margas leading to moksha. So sometimes when you begin to, sort of cherry pick statements, what is the context of that statement? Is that context what is the audience of that statement? What is the context? Is it with regard to a certain ideal? Because there are multiple ideals that can lead. Although I think he puts it together in a doxographical kind of sense, as sort of Nicholson has talked about, through an Advaitic pyramid, ultimately. But this letters between this Paramaradas Mitra, he sort of takes a stand against what I would consider a sort of Pandita Advaita Vedanta, of, we might say, kind of a very commentarial kind of intellectual Advaita Vedanta. And he refuses to, you know, he's sort of speaking for the Advaita Vedanta on the ground, as I like to think of it, and sort of what you might get, and also sort of the hagiographies and sort of narrative traditions, where he says, no, there is avataras. No, there is this kind of mystery beyond, you know, even your philosophy, Horatio kind of thing. And so he's not a pundit. You know, there is this kind of, it's not a dialectical or mimamsa kind of formation of Advaita Vedanta. You know, there's all these different streams that are going on that needs to be kind of, you know, looked at more closely.
And on that Shakta point, I've read in various places that it was generally in private conversations, or I don't know whether also in letters, that he would admit to his Shakta inclinations.
Yeah, his private.
It's my private hobby,
yeah,
or something.
My private
play.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. it's really important work that you're doing there, because it's, you know, people like Jyotir Moy Sharma, I find, you get the impression that they haven't really read anything before the 19th century. So then to read, you know, Vivekananda in
that's
in
yeah, that's, I mean, this, I attempted more of diagnostic here, because there seems to be a two confluences of streams. You know, one is sort of Indology, return to sources,
mm-hmm.
classical Shankara stuff. The other is colonial context.
Mm.
That's it. All causality is developed in the colonial context.
There needs to be some kind of
and there's just absolutely no understanding or even inclination to look at what's happening right before the colonial context, and what are the sources, and what are what transformations are happening that are not just, you know. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess on that note, a little thing. Round of applause.
Thank you.